This is why we love racing in all its forms.
And it's Lock and Varats, Pride's Easy Feed Victoria Cup.
Brodsky beat Clear, All Outfit wins the Sandown Cup.
Twilight Pavement, what a ride, what a win in a cup we'll never forget.
For the next hour, RSN is cracking the codes.
We are indeed cracking the codes like we do every Saturday morning, and I'm joined by my RSN buddies, Matt Stewart and Dan Malecki. Good morning, boys. Matt, been happening in your world this week?
I'm a bit bleary-eyed, Simone, more than normal.
Really?
Royal ascotitis.
Oh, okay. That's a good disease to have.
It is. It's not a bad affliction to have. So I hooked into day one because I wanted to see Palace Pier go around, who's the next big thing, the most beautiful thing you've ever seen since Enable, and then sort of got going with that, backed a few winners, and then day two, and I sort of wasn't going to, but then I sort of found a couple of early trifectas because I read the pattern, Dan, down the outside rail, up the straight, and then kept going and going and going. So now I'm always bleary-eyed, but I'm times two today.
Oh, well, you've got Dan and Ida to you up this morning at 6 a.m, and Dan, how's your week been?
Very good. It's funny, Royal Ascot comes into the equation, but I've had a few late nights with the French Open and, of course, the Euro Soccer Championships as well. So I feel like I should be living in the Northern Hemisphere this week. Add Royal Ascot into the mix. And I'm very much a night owl.
Did you catch much of it or any of it, Simone?
No, I haven't. My only memory of Royal Ascot, which is actually, it ties in perfectly with our guest, one of our guests today, is watching Black Caviar, which was it 8 or 9 years ago to today, June the 19th, 2012 or 2013, where Black Caviar went over to Royal Ascot. And I remember coming home from, I think it was the Bendigo Dogs that night, and I got home at 11 or 12 in the morning, and I thought, well, I may as well stay up now and watch her with all the fanfare. And I'm so glad I did, because it was one of those races that, it was really the build-up and the way that the British do it, and all the top hats and the tails. And I loved all that pomp and ceremony, but I love watching Black Caviar. And obviously, like everyone else, was a bit worried towards the end of the race there, and particularly when you thought that she'd just gone over the line and she'd eased a bit. So terrific memories, and that's my only memory. But no, I don't do the long nights watching Royal Ascot, I'm afraid.
Well, her muscle man, we'll talk a bit more about the story of Michael Bright a little bit later, but the muscle man for Black Caviar is your guest, Simone, and he's also transcends across to the greyhound world as well, and he's a masseuse muscle manipulator, and he was so important to the Black Caviar story. I'm looking forward to asking him about there always seems to be something new, Dan, that we didn't know about the story of how she nearly didn't run at Royal Ascot. There was all sorts of things that occurred, and even afterwards she got bitten by a swarm of bees. So it'll be interesting to talk to Michael Bryant from his perspective about her health and well-being going in, because it was a real patch-up job, and it was a fascinating backstory as we learn more and more about it. So, but just this week, like, I don't know, there's something about the grandeur of, and Goodwood will show us even more, and then you look at Shanti with the big the white building, whatever they call it, what do you call those things, Simone?
Oh, if it was
those
in
big
India,
old white
it would
buildings.
Be the Taj Mahal, wouldn't it? But
yes.
It's not in India.
Oh, they call it what do they call it? It's like a castle dam, but anyway.
Chateau. Is that where they filmed James Bond's Octopussy? They had a big race course in the back, and I remember Googling it. And it could be that one.
I think it would be Shanti, because there was a big stable. So I remember that one too. That was... yes,
with the horse in the float.
Yeah,
fake horse in the float.
Yeah, there's a bit of a James Bond festival on at the moment on on Netflix. So if you, hey, so there's something about the grandeur, the tracking shots, the beauty of the horses. I don't know. Like when I saw that Palace Pier walking in the mounting yard down, I don't think I'd ever seen a more beautiful animal. And then I thought, well, I thought that about Enable too. I'm not denigrating our horses, but theirs look different.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah, I think you're right. They're fine, slender, athletic specimens, aren't they? The Northern Hemisphere horses, and particularly the way that they're groomed as well. It's not to say ours aren't, because it's a bit like humans. Some are just simply better looking than others, and it's applicable with horses as well. But the ones that stand out really stand out. And I think this is
such an
important
thing. The three of us are gorgeous, by the way.
Well, there's no doubt about that. But
we don't have to worry
one
about
us,
being unattractive.
Between the three of us, we've won about eight fashions on the fields.
You were the most handsome 14-year-old I think I've ever seen.
They called me Adonis and then Zabil.
I remember Les Theodore talking about how all the girls at the stable were in love with you, but you were oblivious. What a wasted opportunity. But anyway.
No, I don't know if I was totally oblivious, but, you know. Anyway.
It's a moment was gorgeous, too. So there you go.
Seeing the horses on the TV, it encourages people to have a bet. When you see something that looks well, you're interested in it. And I think that's why when we're able to dedicate race meetings, particularly on TV, and you see the horses, they are the athletes, and they very much are just that when you're able to look at them pre-parading particularly. But at Ascot, it's as if they're on the stage and they're on the catwalk and they are modelling, and they do. They look spectacular.
It's interesting seeing the catch-up that the English are playing with, the sophisticated way that we interpret races, and they're just getting their head around sectional times, and it was interesting hearing them trying to describe to each other what the sectional splits actually meant. You could tell, and all the comments were like, oh, well, you know, that's all very interesting, but, I'm not really sure about that. And I don't think it really works as much over there with the undulating tracks. Every track's different, so you can't quite compare sectionals from track to track. And I'm not sure the attraction I have to English racing is to dissect it in that way. I sort of see it, as you said, as a beauty pageant, and, you know, and you got to find the winners. There was a massive fast lane for most of the week on the grandstand rail as well.
Another ambulance track.
Yes, exactly. So, anyway, Simone, what I think you should do, I know you have a busy life and, you know, testing children and things like that, but when Goodwood comes on next month, you got to watch A Night of Glorious Goodwood because it is beautiful.
Okay, I'll make that a job to do. I'll do that because I'll probably, I don't know, be getting up early in the morning anyway, so I can just do like what you do, just stay up
an all-nighter. Do an all-nighter.
Yeah, just revisit some younger years, perhaps, something like
that.
But hey, guys, last week, remember we were talking about the Stradbroke Handicap and some of the funny names of the horses, including one called Wiggle, that won the Stradbroke back
Wiggle
in the
won
days.
It as a two-year-old. Actually won the Stradbroke as a two-year-old. She was a superstar over there. Up there. But she was a super, super-duper star.
Well, any name sounds good when the horse is a winner, doesn't it? But I was at the library the other day with my daughter, Darcy, and she was fossicking around for some books, and I thought, I'll head over to the racing section. Who knows what's over there? So I went over there, and I came across a book called Drongo. Now, I read the first paragraph, and I can't actually repeat it on air, what the description of a Drongo is, but it was about the horse Drongo that... He made the word Drongo famous because after 37 starts, he never had a win, although he did run second in a derby, ran in two Melbourne Cups and was in some group races. So he actually made the name Drongo part of our common...
Vernacular.
And
Edgar Britt's another one, Dan, a jockey who became a rhyming slang. And Les Boots was sort of... He became a vernacular man because... I'll tell you the story of Les Boots just quickly... He had that many falls, Simone, that his wife would pack him pyjamas and a toothbrush every time he went to the races because she knew that most of the time he'd end up not coming home, he'd end up in hospital.
Autumn Leaves. And is that the one with the nicknamed Autumn Leaves?
Autumn Leaves
because he kept falling.
Yeah, exactly. And Edgar Britt, of course, is rhyming slang for being a major hit, you know. So if you're a major hit, you know, you're an Edgar.
Okay, well, I'll have to remember
that.
That's
right,
Well, I'm not sure. I think there's a few options there. Drongo ran second in 1923 Victoria Derby behind Frances Tressady. Now, there's even a race named after Frances Tressady, so she was an outstanding filly/mare. And Drongo ran in the 1923 Melbourne Cup. Now, you mentioned, 37 starts without a win?
Yes.
Batali won that cup. Drongo went around as a 10-to-1 shot. So... he goes down as being a racing maiden, but he was very much fancied. I think it was more, by the sounds of it, he had that much ability. It was a frustration thing that created that word that lived on afterwards for being a non-winner, a Drongo, because he must have been pretty good. He just didn't win.
Absolutely.
And I think Simone Drongo became not as much about, and you can't repeat the foreword to the book on Drongo, but it wasn't much about someone who didn't win. But I remember when I was growing up, if my old man called me a Drongo, which was quite often, it was more in reference to being a Drongo. Like a bit, you know, sluggish at times.
Well,
in
a refined sense, a fool, a stupid person, a simpleton. But there was actually a lot of thought went into the name Drongo, because he was by a horse called Lanius. And Lanius is to do with the biological classification of birds. So,
as if we didn't already know that.
Yeah, so that's where Drongo, there was actually a lot more to it. But there was also a poem written about Drongo. Would you like me to read you some poetry? Because I know Dan's got some lined up as well. But Drongo wasn't such a Drongo, but of course the legend grew, and legends are stronger than truth, so everyone believes now that Drongo was an old camel who always ran last. But some of us remember a colt running second in a derby. He didn't look so clumsy just for that second. Sure, he never won a race. Neither did I, mate. Most of us never win races, and so they call us Drongos. So his legend lives on in our everyday lives, and we'll just, a fool, a simple person is a little bit more refined than the words that are in the book.
And my old favourite windbag, of course, that's now anyone who's had too many baked beans, becomes that, so...
Watching Blazing Saddles.
And he was a champion of the 1920s. Exactly right. Dan, a couple of interesting harness races tonight, and we're going to do some lovely replays later on. But if you want to just touch on one of the nicest or the most curiously named paces or trotters of all time was Noopy Kiosk.
It is, and a superstar 2 and 3 year old trotter. He was very much compared to the great Maori's idol through his juvenile years. And tonight at Melton, the Saturday Note program is a good winter program, but the features of the Noopy Kiosk Trotters Free for All and the Blossom Lady for the mares. And Blossom Lady has to be one of the greatest mares I've ever seen and one of the greatest to have ever been involved in harness racing, a New Zealand Cup winner and a two-time Hunter Cup winner. And she also, this gets back to your theory at times of champion horses, champion mares, not producing a great winner. She did sort of a Horlicks, because Horlicks produced Brewer, won the 2000 Melbourne Cup. Blossom Lady won 200 cups, and she produced the 2400 cup winner, Mr. DG.
There you go. Hey, Simone, what to Chris Alford, champion, legendary driver of thousands of Group 1 winners and a Hall of Famer, and Matt Stewart have in common?
I think you'd better tell us, because I'm not sure.
We've both driven Noopy Kiosk.
Oh, that's exciting.
I sat behind him up at Chris and Barry's place. Remember, Dan, when they were up Romsey Way many years ago? Adam Hamilton and I went up. And Noopy Kiosk was the superstar of the day, and Barry Alford let me sit in the sulky and walk Noopy Kiosk along the shell grid.
Wow.
And I could think of was how easy it would be to slide off that little chair.
For the horse to take off on you.
Beautiful horse, wasn't he?
Lovely.
He was a magnificently coloured, and he, for a trotter as well, he was really well put together. I know sometimes we use that word athletic because, you know, you've mentioned the Roman nose and the greyhounds before, and that's very much a factor in a lot of those dinner-plated standardbreds over the years. But he was quite a fine specimen, you know. He was a different-looking type of trotter at the time.
But he was a Drongo. He was erratic, wasn't he?
Yeah, look, he was, but he was erratic and he was still winning, though. That's how good he was, very much in that Maori's idol mold. Should we indulge in some of those replays now, or do you want to wait till later?
Yeah, let's...
We do?
Why wait?
Why wait, exactly? Why put off to tomorrow what you can do today?
You never know what tomorrow will bring, Dan.
Here's a reminder of the great trotter, Noopy Kiosk.
National Interest was trying to get through, but now he sprints up. Oh, he was just finding another gear, that was all, and he raced 10 metres in front, Noopy Kiosk, of National Interest, and about 20 metres to Crown of Glory. By goodness, they've left the others standing. They're glued still as if they were statues, but Noopy Kiosk into the straight with that quarter at 29.6. He's 6 or 7 metres in front. You've got to give credit to National Interest. He is certainly above average, but what do you call Noopy Kiosk? He's got to be a superstar. He beats the above average National Interest by 5 metres. Noopy Kiosk first in the home field, second National Interest, 25 metres away.
Who was that handsome young fella behind the mic?
Yeah, it was back in the younger days, wasn't it? But and we're going back a while. Isn't it funny sometimes we relive a great horse? And in this case, obviously, you can hear my voice. But back in my more youthful days, but it brings back some great memories just the same. As does the Blossom Lady. I remember growing up, and it was, I think I was still practicing calling at the races at that stage, so still a teenager. She came from New Zealand with quite a reputation. She was a regular coming over to Australia, and she won the Hunter Cup on two occasions, back when it was a stand start, and she was tough. Really tough. And this is the way she did it, remembering later on she would produce a Hunter Cup winner herself. The first of her Hunter Cup victories, Blossom Lady.
And the leader now taking over, Blossom Lady, went straight past Old Black Joe, under pressure on the inside, travelling into second place in Christopher Vance, then Golden Rain. Chokin's about to pull out four wide. He's winding up now, followed by Cura Harpo Lord. The Unicorn needs a run between runners, followed by Ultra Jet, then Lord Greystoke. Lord Muckley right off the track, followed by Guitar Magic Aberdeen, and Gordon Gecko back of the tail, around the home turn of the Hunter Cup towards the 250, and Blossom Lady got away, the mare by 6 metres, into second placing is Christopher Vance, then Golden Rain. Chokin's under plenty of pressure, but it's all Blossom Lady at the 150. Oh, she's blooming good. She got away from Christopher Vance, down the outside the Unicorn with Golden Rain, but here she is, the millionaireess Blossom Lady. She takes out the Hunter Cup. She bolts in. Blossom Lady by 6 metres. Christopher Vance has run second.
What about those hacks Superstar. That she was beating, Dan?
Yeah, that's right. That's the most enjoyable part of a lot of these replays. It's not just reliving a great performance by the winner, but it sort of escalates their performance because of the opposition that they are humbling. And they were just a bunch of superstars. What an era that was.
Golden Rain, Chokin, towering figures in that era. And Simone, it was one of those rarities that we've often spoken about, these little quirks of all these three codes that we talk about, is Norm's Daughter was another one, Blossom Lady. There are, you can count on one hand the mares that have been Grand Circuit class in harness racing.
Yep. And she's one of them. I just, well, something I did pick up in that call, it was very, just slipped in there. She's blooming good, Blossom Lady. Yeah. I thought that was that was something
Markovic,
I picked up listening to that.
Very good at throwing those little lines in like that. And, you know, he was the voice of the trots back in those days. And, yeah, it brings, look, it still puts the hair up on the back of my neck. The same thing happened last week with Campaign King. And some of these replays and these horses, and Matt and Simone, it can be horses or greyhounds, but you don't directly pinpoint it, but collectively they are the reasons, I think, why we're involved in these industries, because of moments like that at a very impressionable age. And it just, they were rock stars.
And it reminds you, Simone, of the importance of the broadcast for context. I know I've spoken about this a few times, and I remember the day I was at Flemington, and I was actually at Epsom Downs in England for the Derby once, and the PA stopped, and they were still running a
really?
Race. And yeah. I was at, and they didn't seem to care over there either. And I was at Flemington one day, and the course, it was Frank O'Brien, the days when Frank O'Brien was the course broadcaster, Dan, at Flemington.
Yeah.
And it was
yeah.
a significant race, and then all of a sudden there was no broadcast, and it seemed pointless. I was watching these horses run around, and it seemed like there was no context, and that's what the right, and Dan's probably, there's none better really across any code, but the theatre is created 80% by the call and 20% by the action, I reckon.
I yeah, think you're right there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I can't talk about myself, Simone, but it's when you go to the races and you hear that sort of atmosphere, and then you say you go to the footy, watch an AFL game. And when you're there live sitting in the grandstand, it seems as if it's the one thing that you're missing. Maybe we're just too used to watching it off the TV and getting the quality callers. Whereas at the soccer, you go to a soccer game and there mightn't be a broadcast per se, but the crowd's involvement is far more significant than, say, at an AFL match. It can happen at times at the AFL, but at the soccer, it's quite different. The crowds sort of get absorbed and they start chanting and singing, and it's quite a different style of atmosphere.
It is. And Simone, I, years ago, 15 years ago, when at the Herald Sun, I went to the footy, and I'm not a footy head, and I went to the footy with a few mates one night, and I sat there not knowing what was going on because I didn't know who the players were and they were a long way away. There was no commentary unless you brought your wireless with you, and no one really tends to do that. And I did a comment piece, like an opinion piece with the paper, saying, if it was a race meeting, you'd be yelling and screaming that there's no commentary. Why do we have these football games and cricket games and that where there's no arena commentary, you know. It sort of happens, there's an equivalent, like basketball sort of half does it a little bit with the sort of the countdown clocks and all that sort of stuff. And it got a mixed response. I think 80% of people said, don't touch our game, we like it the way it is and we don't need a commentary. But 20% said, yeah, it's weird. And they hadn't yet built Etihad Stadium. And it sort of gained a bit of a discussion about whether they might be able to trial it at Etihad. And then a mob got hold of me that said, it's funny you wrote that because we are about to start marketing a little thing that you can get when you walk into the footy where it's just tuned into one station and it's a little $2 throwaway sort of device that you just put in your ear. And I think they actually launched it and it didn't really take on, but it was... But do you find that interesting that if you went to the races and there was no commentary, it would seem pointless, but you go to the footy and there's no commentary and it doesn't seem to make much difference?
Look, it's even you look for a replay on YouTube to put onto the show and, you know, you might not have the audio on the iPad or your phone or whatever, and you've got to go back to the start because you don't actually know what's happening. It's all about painting that picture, isn't it, of what's actually unfolding in front of you in live time. So, yeah, I agree with you. We need the callers there and need them to let us know what's going on, basically.
Well, when you get into an aeroplane, you hand out the headsets. Imagine during the carnival, for example, people, a lot of them have reserved seats. They don't even move from their seats throughout the course of the day, or those that are sitting down to watch the races. And if there was a headset that was plugged in, and for example, it could be the audio would be the spring ticket or the Melbourne Cup, our digital program on RSN, and they plug into that and they can listen to that all day. And in particular, the race calls of Matty Hill through the course of the day. In this day and age where they're upgrading all those sorts of things, particularly the seating, I reckon that would be fantastic.
Even trial it in the corporate areas and so on. Anyway, we have run the clock, so to speak, and we've got a couple of really interesting guests today. And Simone, our first, as you say, our sense of timing is impeccable as always, given Royal Ascot. Tell us about our first guest.
Well, Michael Bryant's joining us this morning, and his late father, Ned Bryant, was the topic of our conversation 2 weeks ago on the show, Matt, when you weren't here, and received some terrific feedback on that show talking about Ned Bryant. And then through social media, you know, the interview was passed on to Michael Bryant, his son, and Michael, you know, contacted me and said, oh, it was great listening to that. And so I thought, right. Then I found out he was actually Black Caviar's chiropractor, muscle manipulator, amongst other horses, of course, but she's probably the most famous. And so I contacted Michael to see whether he'd come on the show because he crosses both codes beautifully, the greyhounds, and he can relive some memories with his dad, Ned, and also talk about the thoroughbreds. And Matt, I know you'll be, and Dan, you'll both be all across that too. And like you said, the timing with Royal Ascot tonight and... you know, Black Caviar all those years ago winning it. So I thought this is the perfect opportunity to have Michael Bryant on the show.
No, absolutely. And as I said earlier, I'm just there's so many layers of the onion, Dan, with the Black Caviar story in Royal Ascot. And Michael Bryant's actually on the line now, Simone, and he's going to touch on that and all things greyhound as well. G'day, Michael. How are you?
G'day, Matt. How are you?
Not bad. I've got Simone and Dan with me.
Michael, great. It's been great talking to you during the week, but also great that you can join us on the show this morning. And you've had a career that I'm sure we're not going to do justice to in the short time we have this morning. But can you just take us back right to the start, growing up with your dad, Ned Bryant, the legendary trainer and muscle man that everyone talks so fondly of, and just give us a bit of a description of the days going to the races and growing up with Dad and learning his craft of manipulating greyhounds and looking for injuries.
Yeah, well, Dad was certainly a forerunner in trying to figure out the greyhound's injuries. And he was such a dedicated trainer that he wanted to know every part of training. So he made it his business to find out how to fix them and treat them. So as a kid growing up with him, I was also interested in that as well. So I sort of went everywhere with Dad. If we'd go to the races together, I was only a kid. And when he would examine the dogs, I'd be with him and he'd be teaching me from a young age, you know. And it was just such a great time because he was getting plenty of winners at the time and it was just good fun to be around, you know.
Sounds like he might have tapped into a winning formula because these days I don't think there's any animals more massaged than greyhounds. You're often seeing them being sort of lubed up and massaged even before they go into the boxes, and the way the tight turns and so on. Michael, did your dad quickly discover that greyhounds as much as anything, and maybe even more so than thoroughbreds, have major muscle issues, and once you resolve them, you can get a really good result?
Yeah, well, that's true. Greyhounds mainly they get more muscle injuries because of they basically go from the starting box to flat out straight away, the very first try they take. So there's no warming up. Like the horses have a chance to warm up in the pre-parade ring and then sort of cantering on the way to the barriers, where a greyhound doesn't get that opportunity. So they therefore suffer more injuries. So when you see people massaging their dogs and loosening them up, that is to warm the muscles up to get them in shape, rather than they can't warm them up any other way like they can with the horses. So Dab was onto that early days, and he made that part of his routine, that he would massage them prior to going to the boxes and also at the boxes, and it's a thing that took off pretty readily.
Michael, I was chatting with Dean Lester. Dean, big fan of your dad and yourself, and we were having a chat. And you probably heard me on air as well last time mentioning that my granddad and my uncle had greyhounds, and I recounted as stories of them going to your place, and they used to queue up. They used to be these long lines. It was almost like the soup kitchen. People lined up to go and to see your dad. He was like Gandhi, it seemed. He could heal anything.
Yeah, they were really heady days. He had lots of clients from all over the country. I remember once sitting in the shed with him, and the next bloke walked in to get his dog checked, and Dad said, introduced himself, and he said, "Where are you from, mate?" And he said, "I'm from Cairns." And he said, "What are you doing down in Melbourne?" And he said, "I brought the trailer that load of dogs down to get fixed up by you, and I'm heading back straight away when you look at them. They just come from everywhere." And he had such a good name, such a good reputation. It didn't matter whether your dog was in the same race as what his dog was in. He gave the very best of attention. He was very fair, and he was, as you well know, he's good at his trade.
Has it advanced much? It still seems to be very, this is going to be sound like a ridiculous pun, but very hands-on. It's I know there were the massage machines that have been used, and they've evolved over the years, but is it still basically hand on horse? Is that basically what it comes down to?
Yeah, so it's basically it's hands on horse or dog, and then the way we treat those muscle or skeletal injuries often then varies. So we have new machines which come out. Back in the old days, they had ferritic stimulators, which were like the TENS machines. Then they progressed to ultrasound machines, therapeutic ultrasound machines, and now they have shockwave machines, which all they do is, but once you find the injury, then those machines actually repair them. And of course, if they need manipulating, well, that's a different story. That's a hands-on thing if they need an adjustment from having a spine impingement. But the machines have evolved, and not so much the actual practice of finding the issue.
Michael, your dad had only a handful of dogs, and like you mentioned to me, it seems like he had a lot, but he only had a handful of dogs in the backyard there, and one of those greyhounds he had at one stage was Franklin Dino, who ran second in the 1990 Australian Cup, and also he ended up going on to win the 1991 Australian Cup. And we spoke a couple of months ago about this with Des Dooley, who had an interest in the greyhound as well. But there's a really interesting story before we listen to the replay. Or should we listen to the replay first? How about we listen to the replay first, and then you can tell us afterwards why it was such a significant win for you and or for your family, but your dad in particular.
Set to go. The favourite in the pink, ready. Racing Giant began smartly with Shining Arnie. Franklin Dino flew the boxes and he's been able to hold them out on the first turn. Liberator fell after 50 metres. Franklin Dino led them into the first turn over Ravello. Star Chariot up racing third, followed by Giant, then Sheedy, then came Shining Arnie, and last of all was Maluna Boy. Down the back, and the leader is Franklin Dino. Can he do it for Ned? He's three or four in front. Ravello is racing second, followed by Star Chariot. Around the turn, Franklin Dino up hard against the fence. He's careering away and he's done it for Ned. Brian, Franklin Dino wins the Australian Cup.
Dino's win was a much-needed shot in the arm for veteran Cranbourne trainer Ned Bryant, forced to listen to last night's big race from a hospital bed after a serious car accident 10 days ago.
We called in to see Ned in hospital this morning, and it really gave him a great kick, and he looks extra well for what he's been through.
Michael, perhaps you'd like to just let our listeners know exactly what Dad had been through, because quite a significant moment there.
Yes, well, as they said, he had an accident. He ruptured his aorta, and he was in the Dandenong Hospital for a couple of weeks in intensive care. And the dog had qualified for the Australian Cup. The Australian Cup was the only major race that Dad had never won. He'd won like every other feature race on the calendar, and that's the only race that had eluded him in his whole career. And now he was in his hospital bed and couldn't do much from there. So my brother-in-law, Billy Van Polen, and I, we looked after the dog until that dog went to the races and he'd won the race. But every day we had to go to hospital, to the Dandy Hospital, and we took a clipboard in with a bit of paper on there and a biro, and Dad would give us instructions what to do with the dog that day, like walk it this far, feed it that, give it those vitamins, and so on. And the next day we'd go in again, and he would write down. He couldn't see the paper, but he was just writing on the paper blindly, and then his hand would slip off onto the bed sheet and write on the bed sheet, and we'd put his hand back on the bit of paper, and he'd write again. And then his alarm started going off, and the nurse came over and said, look, you're upsetting your father, and we'll have to sort of kick you out. And I said, look, if he doesn't tell us what he wants to tell us, all his alarms will go off, so we need to finish writing what we need to do to his dog. And we've done that every day for about 10 days straight, followed his instructions to the T, and it was like a fairy tale ending into his career. That was his last ever runner, and it had been the only race that had eluded him in his whole career.
Well, talk about dedication. Feverishly writing down the instructions there. Michael, you moved on from... It's mainly hindquarters, isn't it? So you moved on to small buttocks to big buttocks when you moved from the greyhounds to the gallopers. I needed to clarify that. Tell us about that transition, and is it like for like, or is there a completely different beast altogether when you're trying to work on a thoroughbred compared to a greyhound?
It all started out when I was in my early 20s. I was treating greyhounds in Shepparton in Victoria, and Dad sort of based me over that side of Melbourne, and he was doing the south side. And a bloke brought his dog to me once, and we manipulated its shoulder. And he said to me, I think what you just done to that greyhound, I think my sister's horse has the same sort of an injury. Would you have a look at it? And I said, oh, well, I would, but I said, I don't really know if I can help it. Anyhow, next day, the bloke came with his sister and brought the horse over and done a bit of work on it and fluked getting it right. And then we started getting phone calls to look at horses, and I thought, well, I better study up on this. So I made myself available to go to a knackery where they were kind enough to let me sort of cut them open after they'd been put down and have a look at the workings of the horse. And I'd done that very often, and I'd managed to get an extensive library on horse skeletal and muscular issues. And then that's how I progressed to the horses. And basically, they're the same as a greyhound, but the only thing with a horse is when they tear a muscle, it's obviously a lot bigger and a lot easier to find. That's the superficial muscles only. The ones in deep, obviously, they're hard to find, but you get an idea where they are sore. And that's when some of these machines come in handy, those deep scanning machines, scintigraphy and so forth.
Well, I reckon
basically the same issues, yes.
You must have been early loaded with whatever you had machinery-wise and expertise and instinct when you began helping out Peter Moody, and then a dark brown filly came your way who went on to become one of the greatest horses of all time. And there was an early muscle issue from memory when she stumbled out of the gates at Flemington at her second or third start and wrenched herself. And
Danehill
Stakes it might have been. So, Michael, just take us through that as a starting point, and then we want to talk about, obviously, Royal Ascot this week, and it's been 8 or 9 years since Black Caviar. Just what was going on at the time and the concerns behind the scenes. But just that, your first impressions of Black Caviar and then the type of challenges that she presented you as a muscle man, including that Danehill Stakes and then into Royal Ascot.
I first saw her when she came to our farm out of Bales as a yearling, and we spelled her. We spelled a lot of Peter's horses out there. And she was always a bit of a pig. She loved her food, you know. We'd have her in the paddock with three other fillies, and she'd have a bite of her feed, and then she'd chase the next filly away and have a bite of hers and so on until she'd done the rounds and then back to her bin. So she was always a massive eater, but she turned out to be a really big girl. And so the bigger they are, the more their muscle issues are accentuated. So that start you were talking about was her third start at Flemington, and she tore a chest muscle, and it was quite a big tear. And we worked on that with ultrasound treatment, and we kept her out of the swim. Pete loves to swim his horses. We kept her out of the swim for as long as we possibly could before feet started tearing his hair out. And once that healed up, then she was full swing back into work. But she had a few niggles along her way, like most horses do. But because of her size, those issues were a little bit more accentuated.
How often would you have had a look over her? Obviously, from that particular injury, I would imagine Pete would be, looking at every of the finest details to make sure she was right. So were you regularly overseeing her physical state?
Yes, we looked at her basically after every time she did fast work, which would be sort of once a week, and we examined her for... like we do all horses, for anything that shouldn't be there, we would locate that and then we'd work out how to treat it. And, so quite regular she was looked at.
Michael, there must come such a responsibility, and particularly when you're working with horses of that calibre, but you owe the owners and the trainers of the horses that might just be a maiden or something that's struggling to get to the track the same sort of expertise as you do the Group 1 winners. Can you just tell us give us an indication of what it must be like with that responsibility? Do you just go in and think, right, I'm just treating them, it's just a horse here, or do you have a certain, is it a harder task when you've got a horse like Black Caviar?
Well, we try and treat them as just a horse. So if you treat them any other way, then your judgment can become a little bit clouded. So we just sort of try and treat them as an animal that suffers injuries. We try and find them and we treat them or recommend how to treat them. Often the staff treat them with the ultrasounds and so on. But you can't sort of categorise one horse against the other, because then you might lose your judgment. The only thing with Black Caviar, after she won about the 16th start in a row, I realised then that the jockey knew how to ride her. The trainer knew how to train her. If I missed something, that could be the end of her sequence. So then I started to feel a bit of pressure after about win number 16, thinking that, well, possibly I could be the weak link, because everyone else knew their job there. And I thought, I just can't afford to miss anything, because we can't afford to have her getting beaten the way she was going. So a bit of pressure I felt after about win number 16, yes.
It's funny how you talk about treating her like any normal horse or any other horse. I was one of my kids wanted one of her shoes, one of her plates, and I went around to Moods' one day and I happened to be there and I said, oh, Maxie wants one of Black Caviar's shoes, if that's okay. And he said, yeah, no worries. Hey, Barry, or whatever the bloke said, there was a big bin full of used shoes. He goes, just pull one out of there, he won't know the bloody difference. Hey, Michael, the Royal Ascot story, and it is obviously the anniversary of it this week. I remember before she left, Moods had her in the Cathy Freeman body-hugging suit, and when he pulled it off in front of the media, I don't want to sound like a smarty, but Michael Hedge from AAP and I were there, and everyone was gasping about the beauty of Black Caviar, and he took the suit off, and we both felt she looked like she was absolutely at the end of her tether and that this was going to be a hell of a mission. And then she went over there, and there were just issue after issue. I don't know whether you accompanied her on that trip, but if you did, great. But if you didn't, just the memories of what a battle it was behind the scenes leading up to that Golden Jubilee that year?
Yes, well, I went over with Peter about 2 weeks before the race, and the horse went over about 2 weeks prior to that. And I think Pete says somewhere that he maybe shouldn't have raced her in Adelaide at the second run, and but he probably thought that was a bit much for her. But anyhow, she got over there and it was she didn't do that well over there to start with. She had a few things go against her, and she had a thick woolly coat when we got there. And but look, he knew the horse backwards, he knew what he had to work with, and she was one of the toughest horses I've ever seen, probably the toughest. And Pete knew what he had to work with, and even though she probably wasn't at her best, he still pulled the right rein and decided to run her in that race and got the result. She had a little issue there that resurfaced about 5 days before the race. She had an injury, small injury, as a three-year-old, and she just tweaked that the week of the race over there. So the boys just worked on her frantically and kept it nice. And come the day before the race, Pete decided that she was sound enough and good enough hopefully to still win, and that she did, even though by just the barest of margins. But it was a good call by Pete to race her, and Luke copped a fair bit of flack for his ride on her. But I think the instructions were to Luke was just to ride how you normally do, and Luke did that, got to the front, put her in cruise control, but then she stopped because she was hurting. So it wasn't Luke's fault at all that she stopped. She stopped of her own accord because she was hurting, and Luke didn't know that. So Luke then got her going, and I think it was one of Luke's best rides ever. He got her, picked her up and got her over the line first, and he copped a lot of flack over that ride incorrectly.
Well, let's relive the way that Black Caviar became royalty in the Northern Hemisphere.
Now Nolan starts to shake the reins at Black Caviar. She starts to move up on the near side. She draws level now with a furlong left to go. Now he says go on the mare. She gets about a half length in front of Sol. Restia d'Argent, Moonlight Cloud coming home fast, but it's Black Caviar in front with 100 yards left to go. Here's Restia d'Argent and Moonlight Cloud. He eases up near the line. Here's Moonlight Cloud. It's tight. Black Caviar and Moonlight Cloud in a photo. In third.
There was a large group at the City Square, Federation Square. I was sitting in the couch in front of the last embers of an open fire at about 1 o'clock in the morning. Michael, where were you positioned for that?
I was near Peter on the inside of the track near the winning post at Royal Ascot. And from where I was standing, I thought she got beat. And I walked over to Pete and I said, I think she's got beat. And he said, no, I think she's won. So then I just walked away and waited for the number to come down, and thankfully she got the money. It was a bit of a strenuous wait for the photo, for the number to come down.
Michael, in all the years that you've been manipulating greyhounds and horses, would a moment like that be one of the top moments of your career, could you say?
It's definitely a standout moment for me, yes. To be lucky enough to be able to work on a horse of that calibre, and I've been luckily associated with quite a good few good horses over the years, but to be associated with her, you know, I find myself extremely lucky and pretty proud as well. But she was probably the best horse that I've ever been associated with.
I think we need to have you back on Cracking the Codes some other time, because it's been absolutely wonderful and fascinating talking to you. And we've just spoken about one horse, and like we've mentioned, that there must be so many, many other horses that have given you such satisfaction getting them back to the track or helping them along with their injuries. So it's been an absolute pleasure for us, I think, having you on the show this morning and talking about your dad, Ned. And I know there's plenty of our listeners that will be loving this interview this morning, particularly given the feedback from a couple of weeks ago. So we thank you very, very much for joining us on Cracking the Codes this morning.
Thank you, guys.
Very interesting and intelligent guy. And if we do get him back, Simone, I'm pretty 99.9% sure that he accompanied Moods on some of those trips to the battlefields of Palestine and all that. Moods is a great war historian in Gallipoli and so on. And I reckon there was a lovely photo of him sitting in a bar in Istanbul one night where they had about 4,000 beers sitting on a table. So that'll be part two. Anyway, well, hey, we're running out of time. We're going to take a short break because Dan's got a fantastic guest coming for us after this break. So we will take this break on Cracking the Codes.
Loving their racing, pacing and chasing. Matt Stewart, Dan Malicki and Simone Fisher. Cracking the Codes.
My special guest this morning is a harness racing historian, and we're so appreciative to be able to have someone that is able to get some of the things that we really preciously need in harness racing, and that's memorabilia and a historical element to it. And Noel Ridge has just about single-handedly created a memorabilia site and through the Bendigo Harness Racing Club, come up with some fantastic mementos, memories, history of harness racing. Not just at Bendigo, but he's certainly an expert in that area. And it's great to have him join us this morning and tell us about the next stage, an important stage in the building of the history of harness racing. Good morning to you, Noel.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Yeah, look, we're well. How are you going? You've been pretty busy uploading and digitalization of your history of harness racing and memorabilia. It sounds like it's quite a difficult process, but obviously a very important one that you've been undertaking over the last few months.
Dan, just a correction there. The collection was actually started a long time ago by John Hall, who unfortunately passed away. But Norm West, a colleague of mine, is equally involved. So it's not just me on my own. There's two or three and an increasing number of people. But we were lucky enough to obtain a grant from Australian Museums and Galleries Association to digitise the collection. And we had an expert come up and work with us for 3 days to teach us how to do it. And she's taken the images away to edit them, and they're going up on the Victoria Collections website with the whole catalogue.
Well, how big's the catalogue, Noel? And what sort of eras are we talking about? What are we looking at here?
Well, we're looking at, for a start, maybe we digitised 40 sets of driver's colours. The oldest is 1926, the New Derby. They managed to do the sulkies. We've got 10 historic sulkies, all the trophies, Mary's Idol. We're up to, at the moment, the website has got 360 items on it. And it's easy to find. You just go to Victoria Collections website, just go to search, and then... for instance, Ray Armour Poole has got Gordon Rothiger's colours, the photo finish of the Bendigo Cup, and the complete his race record. So it's we never imagined it would be this big, but we look as though it's possible to digitise most of the treasures.
Noel, when you're searching or coming up with all these different bits of memorabilia, sometimes things pop up that are very, very unexpected. Has there been anything come up that surprised you or taken you for a trip down memory lane that you may have forgotten about?
Well, there's something none of us knew about that came through Western Australia. Somebody was helping an aunt, an uncle, clean up their place prior to a move. And they found an item, and on it had Victoria Trotting Club. So they Googled Victoria Trotting Club, luckily found the Victoria Trotting Club, which is now the, and found a number and called them, and they put them on to me. And it turns out to be the membership ticket for Elstonwick, the Elstonwick racetrack, 1886. And the woman said it was just so close to being thrown out. And nobody's ever seen one of these. It's just amazing.
So Elstonwick had a... See, this is fascinating because Dr. Turf and I did a podcast recently and we unearthed... at one point, there was 26 active racetracks in Melbourne all at the one time, going back about 100 years ago. So the Elstonwick track, Noel, was that a gallops and trots track or just a trots track?
No,
or?
It was a purpose-built trotting track.
Wow.
It's where the Elstonwick Park is now, and it was only operating for about 10 years, and then the Wowsers got into Parliament and shut it down. But the grandstand, they moved holus bolus up to the junction, and it's the one of the grandstands at the Junction Oval is the original Elstonwick Trotting Track grandstand.
Wow, that's amazing. And that's why it's so important that we're able to keep in touch with this sort of history. It seems like it's on a little thread to being lost, Noel. So, and look, there was a couple of other tracks there early 20th century, so in the early 1900s, that were very active and of which you have some race finish photos from, from Richmond and Ascot.
Yeah, we've got them, Dan. Richmond, you can figure out where it was, heading down Bridge Road, just before the bridge on the right. John Wren's Richmond track was there. Ponies, gallops and trots. And we've got a good number of race finish photos from there, and later on Ascot, which is opposite the gates of the showgrounds where the housing estate is there on Ascot Vale Road. They were busy. They were busy tracks.
And we've still got that memorabilia from Bendigo. I tell you, like this one, Matty Stewart. Noel sent me some details. When Sailor's Guide was added into the Hall of Fame just recently, Sailor's Guide came from Bendigo. But the trainer and the connections, they were involved in harness racing as well, Noel.
George Daniel was a local school teacher, trained trotters under a assumed name, D. George, because he wasn't supposed to be doing that. But he had absolute top-class trotters. He won the Richmond 1000 1928-29 and then switched over to the Gallopers and retired from teaching. And one of them was Sailor's Guide, which was recently inducted into the Australian Racing Hall of Fame. So he was a dual code, and he had Group 1 trainee. He trained Group 1 winners in both trotting and gallops.
Hey, Noel, if I want to see this fantastic collection, this memorabilia, how do I go about it?
The physical one or the digital one?
The digital one. How do I access? Yeah, the listeners who are keen to really
okay.
interested. Yep.
All you need to do is Google Victorian collections.
Yep.
And there's a search engine on there, and you just put in Bendigo Harness Racing Collection,
yep.
or try Rayama Pool, and you know, and at the moment it belongs to Museums Victoria, so it's a massive big site, but the search engine works.
So, all right, so if we go Google Victorian Collections and then go into Bendigo Harness Racing Collections, you'll be able to find it and you'll see this sea of interesting things.
And if you can't do it that way, just go with Rayama Pool and that'll get you to the rest of them.
All right, Rayama Pool. Hey, fantastic.
It's slow work and it's under construction, so don't get too excited.
All right, well, it'll come to fruition in time.
And it's building.
It's building.
It's building.
It's building.
But thanks to Noel Ridge.
Just like they built a trotting track at Elstonwick many, many years ago.
If you build it, they will come.
Good on you, Noel.
Yeah.
Hey, great to have you on board again. Look forward to having a chat in the near future as well.
Yeah, good on you. Yeah, look, hopefully people will have a look and see what we're trying to do.
Terrific. Good on you, Noel.
Thank you.
Noel Ridge from the Bendigo Harness
Thanks,
Club.
Thanks, Noel.
They are so, just as we sign off, we've got 60 seconds down, and I know you've got a poem for us, but the Noels of this world are important because they're rekindling something that no one preserved in the first place, so it's so important.
Yeah. A lot of
and don't you wish your history lessons at high school were as interesting as what we're listening to now? I might have been interested.
You might have paid attention and actually passed year 12. Yeah.
And I actually love history, and I didn't at high school.
Yeah, well, there you go. Well, we learn more and more about some of these deficiencies, Dan. Hey, give us a bit of Adam Lindsay Gordon as we sign off on Cracking the Codes.
Well, there's a race named in his honour today, and one of his famous poems on horse racing, I've just collected an excerpt from The Fields of Cold Rain by Adam Lindsay Gordon. On the fields of cold rain, there'll be labour in vain before the great western is ended. The nags will have toiled and the silks will be soiled and the rails will require to be mended. For the gullies are deep and the uplands are steep and mud will of pearls be the token and the tough stringy bark that invites us to lark with impunity may not be broken.